Continuing this chapter on Numpo Cha's visits to the West, we're still in 1977 here, and this section is called All in Your Head. Although Longpo repeatedly impressed his disciples and English hosts with the apparently effortless ease with which he adapted to conditions which were new and strange to him, the acceptance of his environment that he demonstrated was not, the acceptance of his environment that he demonstrated was not indiscriminate. On certain occasions, when he might have been expected to conform with conditions, he showed no inclination to do so at all. One day, for example, it was necessary for him to travel on the underground during rush hour. This is the the underground train system in London, probably most of you are familiar with, in one way, shape or form. It was necessary for him to travel on the underground during rush hour. The atmosphere was hurried and frantic. The monks and laypeople accompanying Longpo felt themselves swept along by the energy of the place. They were surprised and a little irritated to see that, rather than increasing his pace to keep up with them, Longpo had seemed to quite deliberately slow down. One of the monks got the point. They had plenty of time to get to their destination. Why start rushing just because everyone else was? Also, in Lumpur Sumedho's description of that, Lumpur Cha would stop and kind of take his walking stick and poke at various advertisements and say, well, what's this one selling? Or what's this about? Or about the posters for particular theatres or events. And he'd say, tell me about this. What's this? What's going on? Kind of massive flood of people going past them. And so, you know, the wait till he got a description, and then move on, and generally ambling, making his way slowly. In what areas was adaptation appropriate, and to what extent? What were the causes of insufficient adaptation or over-adaptation? What was the wise relationship to customs and conventions? All of these questions were of much interest to Longpo. Observing the customs of the English allowed him to look at Thai customs with a fresh perspective. His reflections on this matter appeared in many talks that he gave on his return to Thailand. During the course of one such talk, he said, "If we invest things with our views and beliefs, then they immediately gain value. They can become sacred or holy objects. But without our projections, nothing has any intrinsic worth. We Thais take the head to be the most exalted part of the body. We don't let anybody touch our heads in jest. It makes us so angry that in the past it's even led people to kill each other. It's because of a view that we won't let people touch our heads, a deeply entrenched attachment. When I was abroad, I saw the Westerners touching each other's heads quite freely. One of the Western monks took me to visit his parents. As soon as we arrived, he put out his hand and touched his father's head affectionately. He stroked his father's head and laughed, and his father was really happy about it. To him, it meant that his son loved him. That's how it is over there." And in one of the similar talk where Lumpur Cha speaks about this, he says, really, you know, it's just a convention that we call the head sacred, but it's really no different from a cabbage. And so, you know, touching a head, touching a cabbage is pretty much the same thing. And so that into to a Thai audience would be like, what? You can't compare someone's head to a cabbage. You know, it's like you know, to say that the cooks here might as well go out to the recycling shed and get some old newspapers and some plastic out of the recycling shed and put it in the dishes and put that on the server and we can eat that instead, like a sort of as crazy and as weird and like, what, plastic and rubbish instead of food? I mean, no, you can't eat that. That's all wrong. That's all back to front. So that, but also Lumpur Cha knew the value of startling people and using kind of shock tactics to get people's attention and helping people to see their own conditioning and their own kind of the value systems that have grown up. And there's one of the most touching passages in Paul Breiter's book, Venerable Father, about his years as a bhikkhu with Lumpur Cha. And he's been trying desperately for weeks and months and months and months to get Lumpur to allow him to disrobe. And he's really despairing because he's been to go and see him and trying to get some time to sit down and ask him if he can disrobe. And one particular occasion where he's like, okay, now I'm sure I've got him. You know, he's over here at Wat Pho Nan Chau, the International Monastery. He's not doing anything else. Now I've got him cornered, you know, and I've got my tray of offerings, candles, flowers, incense right now. He can't possibly find any way out of this. I'm going to put the question to him and he has to go along with it. And then apparently a little while later, he's seen leaving the sala of Wat Pho Nan Chau, shaking his head saying, I need a lawyer. Still with his tray. Somehow Lumpur turned him around and sent him off. Anyway, when he finally managed to disrobe, Lumpur Cha gave him permission to disrobe, there's this really touching moment where Lumpur is leaving to get in the vehicle, and then he turns back and he sticks his hand out, and Waraponyo, and then Paul Breiter, so looked at his hand, and Lumpur Cha said, in English, shake hands. So we never shook hands. So it was one of those very beautiful gestures on Lumpur's part, even though he was going to make Waraponyo work like crazy to get to disrobe. Once he had, then he was also stepping into his world of Western customs. And Waraponyo says, I looked at his hand like it was some sort of strange beast. What's he doing? Why is he like some kind of weird animal? Oh, he wants me to shake hands. Like, which you would never do with an ajahn, but Lumpur Cha had watched how people do that in the West, and that's how they greet and say goodbye and so on. So that was his final gesture with Paul Breiter at that time. So again, he would, through observing how people did that and then putting that to work, so that it was a gesture of saying, okay, now we're on a different basis, and you're a free agent as a layperson once more, and I'm happy to meet you and connect with you as another foreigner. To continue, every culture had its conventions. Problems arose when people gave absolute and fixed values to them. Understanding conventions as conventions and making use of them as appropriate was the wise path. Lumpur said that with the abandonment of wrong views and attachment to conventions, all things lost their former value. This did not mean a moral nihilism, simply that when the blind identification with conditioned phenomena fell away, suffering could find no way into the mind. And one of his most profound and helpful talks on that is called Convention and Liberation. In his collected teachings, is on that same theme, and also following his visits to the West. This next section is called Urban Dhamma. One morning on alms round in London, the monks became aware of a group of teenagers veering towards them. They carried with them a threat of casual violence. Laughing and joking, they shouted insults at the monks and made threatening gestures. To roars of approval from their friends, one or two of them ran up and aimed playful kicks at the line of monks, missing them by inches. They taunted the monks, probing for a response. Ajahn Sumedho began to be concerned that things were turning ugly and prepared to shield his teacher. Lumpur, completely unfazed by it all, continued walking at an unhurried pace, with eyes downcast. Soon the lads became bored with the game and ran off. On safely reaching the entrance to the temple, Ajahn Sumedho went forward to receive Lumpur's alms bowl. Lumpur smiled and said, "Gives good teachings, England, good teachings." And this next section is called Further Still. Lumpur had a certain basic knowledge of Christianity. At Wat Bapong, his Western disciples would occasionally speak about their experiences of it with him. And he sometimes enjoyed discussions with Father Pasek and Pisek, local French priests who are fluent in Thai. So So there were two commissionary Catholic priests who were in the same area. But it's unlikely that Lungpo possessed more than a fundamental idea of Christian teachings, or realized that the Protestant denominations he encountered in England were any different from the Catholicism he had met in Thailand. He certainly did not seem to be aware of how blunt his words might sound to a Christian ear. When the vicar of an old church he was visiting asked him, There's no prayer in your practice. Do you believe it can still take you to God? Lungpo replied, beyond that. On another occasion, Lungpo referred to a belief in gods with a saving power as a hindrance to the realization of the human potential to save oneself. To Lungpo, the preciousness of a human birth lay in the unique opportunity it provided to abandon the defilements powering the whole wheel of birth and death. He was critical of teachings that he saw as undermining a person's determination to take advantage of that opportunity. Those who were unaware that there were defilements in their heart that could be removed with right training tended to allow life to take its course, never achieving a true refuge. In Lungpo speaking here, some take refuge in a God up in heaven and just wait around for him to come and help them. In fact, we can help ourselves. It's just that we don't know how to. We wait for someone else to help us and die with nothing to show for our lives. Buddhists should take responsibility for their lives by following the path towards being one's own refuge. Again, Lungpo speaking here. Knowing our own responsibility, we should keep abandoning defilements, abstaining from evil, doing only good, and then abandoning identification with the good. There was no need to look for an external support. People who loved themselves, in other words, those who truly wished themselves well, should learn how to be their own refuge. Those who had practiced well and gained a true inner refuge were able to create for themselves a world of experience that was full of virtue and peace. By this token, they could be said to be creator gods themselves. So there's a few themes in there. Those of you who have seen the BBC film The Buddha Comes to Sussex, which is widely available on YouTube and often seen here, there's a particular scene in the film where you have Lungpo Sumedho and Ajahn Sucitho and Lungpo Cho meeting with a number of Christian ministers and engaging in philosophical and theological discussion. And the person with the camera did a fantastic job, because you have Lungpo Sumedho sort of having a chat with the bishop and the vicars, and Ajahn Sucitho kind of, yes, well, you could put it that way, engaging in a very sort of Western manner. And then there's this, the camera lingers on Lungpo Cha's face, which is basically saying, what a bunch of morons. these people are really funny, This sort of expression on his face is like, what are these guys talking about? All this kind of verbiage about ultimate reality, and they seem to be taking it so seriously. Don't they realize these are just words? Anyway, it's worth seeing, just probably with the sound off. So you get the Lungpo Cha's face says everything that needs to be said in that particular dynamic. But it's a true classic of religious filmmaking. And also, just to his comments here about taking responsibility, and this really is one of the most significant themes of Buddhist teachings. And so many people come and come to the meditation class here, or they come to different events, or just come to visit, and they ask questions and ask about Buddhism, and not just Westerners, but also often Asian people who haven't really got a clear picture of their own religion. Happens surprisingly often. And this particular dynamic that's described here, because even though it's people who come from Thailand or Burma or Sri Lanka, China and India and places where they have grown up in a Buddhist family or Buddhist culture, that you can think, oh, well, Buddhism talks about self-reliance, but it can still be the main cultural force for many people is praying to the devas so that they'll come along and help you get through your exams, or they'll cure your sicknesses, or your, it's still very much appealing to unseen forces to try and make everything all right for you, so you'll have a comfortable ride through life and get the things that you want, and not get the things that you don't want and such like. I'm not trying to malign people, but it's very, very common that that's the way that people relate to, within a Buddhist culture, it turns into a theistic approach. And so this particular emphasis that Lumpur gives here is very much a theme of the forest tradition in particular, and Lumpur Cha would emphasize over and over again, it's your own heart that does the saving. Don't ask for even the Ajahn to save you or to fix you or to make everything right. But as I've said a few times, when Lumpur Cha had this amazing skill of saying, don't look at me, look at yourself. Don't expect me to save you or fix you, but you have to fix yourself. And even actually today, somebody said, well, I'm looking for someone to make me happy. And I said, well, I'm sorry to tell you, but there's only one person who can make you happy, and that's you. So it's a very significant theme. And on the one hand, it's a sort of childish wish, a childlike wish that we want mum and dad to come along and fix it, and make everything all right. And then if we have had good families and we have had that kind of comfort as children, then there's that memory within us of, mummy came along and kissed it better and everything was all right, or it was broken and it got fixed. Mum or dad fixed it for me and that was good. But it's a childlike approach to religion. It's natural enough. And so what you have in this approach of Buddha Dhamma, of you being your own savior, as it were, it's like it's more challenging, but it's more rewarding. It's like it's up to you. It's not going to come from outside, but it's what changes you make in your own heart, the choices that you make and the work you do on your own mind, that's what's going to make the difference. So it's more challenging, but more rewarding. And so sometimes people will say, Ajahn, tell me, Ajahn, it's all going to be all right, isn't it? I say, well, it might be, but it might not be. It depends on what you do with your life. Well, don't say that. Well, you asked me, and again, I'm not joking. It's not uncommon for that exchange to happen. Tell me everything's going to be all right. We're all going to go to Nibbana eventually, aren't we, Ajahn? Aren't we? Don't we all become enlightened in the end? He says, well, if you want the Buddha's teaching on this, it's like, if you do the right thing, yes, you will. If you don't do the right thing, no, you won't. It goes on and on and on. Samsara is endlessness. It doesn't end. It's endless wandering. So that if you do the right thing, that endless wandering can be brought to an end. But if we don't work with our minds in a skillful way, then it just goes on and on and on. And so so there might be something, that childlike reflex within us that says, don't say that. Tell me it'll all be all right. But the Buddha was often criticized for being a bit blunt or a bit challenging as a teacher. But these are very helpful. It's right. in a way, giving you the straight scoop, as they say, giving you the accurate story. And on this same sort of theme, Lumpur Sumedho would often quote this old movie that he obviously had a powerful impression on him. I don't know what movie it is, but those of you who've listened to Lumpur Sumedho's Dhamma talks will have heard him say it a few times, where the heroine of the story says to the hero, "Tell me that you love me, even if you don't mean it. I don't care if it's not true, I just want to hear you say it." And so Lumpur Sumedho would sort of take that and say, that's what we do as human beings. Tell me it's all going to be all right, even though it won't be. I just want to hear you say it'll all be all right. There's something in us that wants that kind of comfort and a sort of, mummy will kiss it better and then it'll make the pain go away. And so this is a way what Lumpur Cha is saying here, it's a way that we are encouraged to grow up, to take responsibility for our own lives and to not just be seeking the external resources to be the thing that fixes us. And I don't know if it mentions it later on from his 1979 trip, But when he was visiting a Tibetan center up in the north of England, Manjushri, and they are showing Lumpur around, and it's in this this stately home, Conishead Priory, a very grand palatial kind of a place. And they had these big murals, large paintings, tanka paintings, of different bodhisattvas. And they're very beautifully done, and so that they're showing Lumpur around with Ajahn Prabhakara was his attendant and translator, and Ajahn Sumedho was there, the whole group. And so they're showing him through the shrine room and describing these different tankas and what the different bodhisattvas are embodiments of. And so they're quite pleased with these tankas and then these spiritual figures within their pantheon. And then along the way, Lumpur Cha says, "So is this how you teach the children?" This kind of stories of bodhisattvas who are kind of embodying wisdom or kindness. So this is how you teach the kids, is it? So it didn't go down very well. I don't know whether he was meaning to be sort of offering them a reflection or whether it was just an innocent question. But they didn't. Apparently, I wasn't there, but apparently it did not go down very. Didn't go down very well. You know, a similar, I'm just reminded as I'm saying that, when I was in Dharamsala at one of these conferences of Buddhist teachers, and we were being shown around the kind of monastery temple complex where His Holiness the Dalai Lama lives, and they had this, on this one particular shrine room, they had this huge mural of what's called the Kala Chakra Tantra, and so that the... and this, they were saying how if you're doing this Kala Chakra practice, there is this image of this Buddha at the center, and then there's 760 other representations of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas all around. And they were saying that if you're developing this practice, you have to memorize each one of these different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas has got different features, different clothing, different ornaments, different mudras, and you have to memorize each one. You have to be able to visualize every single one with the right configuration of features and jewelry and clothes and in the right places. And then once you can visualize all 760 of them accurately, then and then this person again is giving us this description about how amazing and profound and sort of awesome this practice is. And then when you can visualize all 760 of them, you then bring them together, right at the tip of your nose, right to the tip of your nose. And then I, being a kind of compulsive wisecracker, then I said, so then you're ready for mindfulness of breathing, are you? That didn't go down very well either. Oops. One shouldn't be kind of insulting to other people's practices, at least on purpose, but sometimes it just sort of falls out that way. So the next section is called What a What Is. So What, W-H-A-T, a What, W-A-T, a What, which is the Thai pronunciation of the Pali word Avasa, which means a monastery. Many of the people who came to Hampstead Vihara had little idea of the role that a forest monastery plays in its local community. They would usually assume that monks lived in complete isolation behind high walls, which is often the model that you have in the Christian world and monastic enclosures, you have vows of stability and the monastic community live in a kind of walled community and don't travel outside it very much. And that was the model up until the 60s. It was very, very common. Lumpur explained the truth of the matter to a university lecturer. The forest monastery is deeply involved in the villagers' lives. It's the place where people are taught how to abandon wrong views and how to have a correct understanding of their human birth, how to conduct themselves, how to live life. On observance day, the villagers gather in the monastery, offer the Sangha their daily meal, and take the 8 precepts. They practice meditation to purify their minds. The monks teach and advise them, and give Dhamma talks to help them understand the principles of Buddhism. There are people who, like you in Europe, have never heard of the Buddha's teachings before. Those people are given a better understanding of the teachings. People who don't know about merit and demerit, right and wrong, are taught about them in the monastery. People from every stratum of society learn how to be intelligent about their lives, how to refrain from committing base acts of body, speech, and mind, and how to establish themselves in right conduct of body, speech, and mind. They learn how to reduce conceit and attachment to views, and how to gradually lessen the greed, hatred, and delusion in their hearts until they become true Buddhists, people who know how to share with others and how to live with loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. This next little section is called Counter Questions. The limits of intellectual understanding was a theme Lungpo often returned to. One evening, when a lay meditator asked him to describe the monk's life, he said it would be as difficult as a fish trying to explain its life to a bird. It would not be possible for the bird to imagine what it would be like to live in the water, unless, he added, the bird was reborn as a fish. When someone asked what happens after death, Lungpo extinguished the candle by the side of him and asked her in return, "Where does the candle flame go after it's extinguished?" The questioner looked confused. After a few moments, he said, "Are you satisfied with my answer?" The questioner said, "No." Lungpo said, "I wasn't satisfied with your question either." So then there's a little footnote there. Lungpo answered the question, "What happens to an arahant after he dies?" Whereas it appears that the woman's question was, in fact, a more general one about rebirth. Perhaps the most likely explanation is that she'd asked, "What happens to you after death?" with the "you" being used idiomatically to mean people in general. And this was mistranslated to Lungpo as, "What happens to you after death?" So there was can you follow that? There was a bit of a miscommunication. So he thought it was the way it was translated to him, so what will happen to you when your body dies? And then he put the candle out. And so so then you have that little exchange. But that putting out of the flame is a symbol that the Buddha used. In particular, when he was asked the same question about where does an arahant go when they pass away, or what happens to an arahant at the end of their life, by Vachagota, who was a wanderer who eventually became an arahant. There's a potential for a whole life story of Vachagota. Yeah, anybody ever wants to write one? He was a wanderer who would come and ask the Buddha many, many questions. And so there's quite a number of teachings in the suttas of the inquiries of Vachagota. And one of them is this, when he comes to ask the Buddha about what happens to an enlightened being at the death of the body. And and he says, "Do they reappear in another life?" And the Buddha says, "Reappears does not apply." And then Vachagota says, "Well, do they not reappear?" And the Buddha said, "Well, does not reappear, that doesn't apply either." And then Vachagota, being India, of course, they have sort of a quadrilemma, four-part possibilities. "Well, do they both reappear and not reappear?" The Buddha said, "Both reappears and not reappears, that doesn't apply." And then the last one, "Well, do they neither reappear nor not reappear?" And the Buddha said, that doesn't apply either. And then Vachagota said, "Well, I'm confused, I can't understand this. It's got to be one of those four." And then the Buddha said, "Okay, Vacha, so if we had a little fire here made of grass and sticks burning in front of us, and then the fire went out, and I asked you the question, where did the fire go, north, south, east, or west? How would you reply?" And he would say, "Well, I would say that the question you ask doesn't apply because it didn't go in any direction, it just went out." And the Buddha said, "Exactly. The way you ask the question presumes a reality that doesn't exist. Like Stephen Hawking asking, what's south of the South Pole? You can't go south of the South Pole, because that's where south stops." So that to say where does an enlightened being go when they die, you've got identity, you've got time, you've got location. all woven into that question, where do they go when they pass away? So the Buddha said, you know, the way you ask the question presumes a reality that doesn't exist. So that which can be talked about is no more. Again, in another dialogue of the Buddha with someone called Upasiva, he said, same kind of question, Upasiva asks him, this is in the Sutta Nipata, he asks him, someone who has fulfilled the holy life, who has reached complete enlightenment, when the body passes away, do they no longer exist? Do they disappear? Or do they go into some kind of exalted, perpetual, blissful state? And then the Buddha, again, makes this very, very pertinent comment. He says, one who has reached the end has no criterion by which they can be measured. That which can be spoken of is no more. You cannot say they do not exist. But when all modes of being, all phenomena are removed, all means of speaking have gone too. Okay? One who has reached the end has no criterion by which they can be measured. That which can be spoken of is no more. So our language depends upon seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, three-dimensional space, time, individuality, location. That's the world that we know. Our language, our perceptions are all conditioned by that. If identity, time, and location no longer apply, words, you know, it's like this currency is not valid that side of the border. Like, no, it's not. You can't. that has no value. That has no meaning. No traction on that in that respect. So that the Buddha pointed to this. It's like, you know, you can say that which can be spoken of, like the body or a person or a name or an individual existence. When the body dies, then that's run out. That condition has come to an end. But then you can't really talk about continuing or not continuing or both continuing and not continuing. Or, you know, neither continuing nor not continuing. That none of that applies, because that's all based on individuality, time, location, and so that he was very, very resolute, because people think, well, you know, someone who's an arahant, they must get some really, really nice kind of some sort of super duper permanent heaven that you go to where it's really, really good forever, and he just wouldn't make a single not a hair's breadth of movement in giving any kind of credibility to that. He said, no, words and concepts, they don't apply. Yeah. One who has reached the end has no criterion by which they can be measured. So to our thinking mind, that might be frustrating, but if it's reflected upon, then it's very liberating. And then in that same dialogue with Vajragotha, the Buddha goes on to say, because Vajragotha, he's kind of satisfied with that, but kind of not. So the Buddha starts to talk about his own experience or the quality of his own being there while he's still alive, talking with Vajragotha in that exchange. And he says, that material form, kind of the body or material form, or feeling or perceptions, mental formations or consciousness, that material form and the rest of the five khandhas, by which someone trying to describe the Tathagata would describe him, like saying he's tall or he's male or he's Nepalese or he's wise or he's kind, that material form that people would use to describe the Tathagata, that has been cut off at the root, made like a palm tree stump, deprived of the conditions of existence, and rendered incapable of arising in the future. The Tathagata is liberated from being reckoned in terms of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. He is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the ocean. So, and to me, that's one of the most wonderful exchanges and descriptions. The Buddha talking about his own subjective experience, so that he is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable. As an isness, there's something which is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the ocean, that when you stand at the edge of the sea and you go, wow. But then he also says you can't describe that or measure that in anything like to do with the five khandhas, to do with thought and feeling, perception, doesn't apply. So that again can be frustrating to the thinking mind, but also in terms of the practice, and when we reflect upon our own experience, then it's not just the Buddha talking about his own sort of super exalted consciousness, but it's talking about that quality of awareness, which is the very medium of experience for all of us. When that awareness, that awakened quality, that awakened awareness is freed of all obscuration, then that is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the ocean. It's not female, it's not male, it's not old, it's not young, it doesn't have a nationality, it doesn't have a name, it doesn't have a location. It's present, it's awake, it knows, but it's not a person. It's not an I, not a this or a that. And so then the thinking mind likes to say, right, I am pure awareness, that's what I am. But at that moment, it's taken the idea, I am pure awareness, and attached to the idea. Right? So we create a story about it, or create an image, and then the mind grabs hold of the image and saying, I am pure awareness, that's the true me. Ta-da. No, that's just the mind grabbing hold of a thought. At that moment, it's left the back wall of pure awareness, and it's been born into that thought. This is what I really am. I am the Dhamma, that's me. That's the real me. Then it's, but in that moment, there has been a birth into that concept. And so the practice is remaining as that quality of profound, immeasurable, unfathomable awareness, and then watching the habits of birth, trying to be something or go somewhere or be somebody or do something that continues to habitually arise and take shape. Any questions?
I had one left from yesterday, actually, so it's good that you brought it up again, because I've been thinking about it today. Is the implication that awareness is outside of consciousness? Consciousness is a calendar, and is flow. If awareness is left, then awareness must be not part of consciousness, and my mind can't get around that.
Well, yeah, that's... Well, yeah, it's like the, in a way, that the consciousness is the sort of discriminative activity of the mind at its most refined level, like the pixels in a digital photograph, the individual individual pixels, like the individual dots that make up an image, and then. The awareness is that which knows the dots.
Maybe I'll
do that. Yeah, we'll sit on it for a month or two. But it's a commonly asked question, but if there wasn't some kind of quality of awareness that transcended the five khandhas, liberation would be impossible.
Unless liberation is beyond awareness.
You can take that thought if you like. But... it's like the mind that is that say that the heart was liberated. In the suttas about the Anathalakkhana Sutta or the Dhammacakka Sutta, the heart is liberated. You know, that's referring to that quality that which knows. You know, it is liberated. There's a knowing there, and so that it's tempting to try and make a perfect conceptual map, but the more important thing is to in a sense, realize that quality of clarity of vision as a known experience, as a quality in itself. And when that is actualized, when that is realized, just to know how that changes the nature of experience and the quality of liberation that comes with that.
You mentioned that awareness that it knows. What exactly that it knows? What exactly? Like you did a few days ago, you met the reading you mentioned about knowing the knowing, what exactly is that?
Well, essentially, to all intents and purposes, as they say, what is being known is the arising and passing of the khandhas. Perceptions, thoughts, feelings arising and passing away moment by moment. That's what's being known. Okay, so the next section is called Refugee Dhamma. At the end of June, this is 1977, Lungpo went to France to visit a Laotian disciple, Ajahn Bankau. While he was there, groups of refugees from Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam came to pay their respects, and he heard harrowing tales of the suffering they had endured in their homelands. During one exhortation, he said, "Give up thinking about it. Things that have passed, like the days that have gone by. Don't keep grasping onto them, like thorns to pierce you. Look at it as if you have been reborn. Where is your home? Now, it's right here. You have friends and family here. The place that you've left wasn't really your home. If it was, then you could still live there. In fact, we have no real home in this world. Wherever we live, we simply create a convention that it is our home. But it's not really. Before long, we have to move on. So, while you're here, put effort into being here. Make your life here. Make your peace with being here." And that peace came through the acceptance of change. And again, Lumpur continues. "Wherever you are, it's just like that. There's no essence or core to it, no lasting stability. The world is continually changing. If you go back and live over there, it'll change. If you stay here, it will change. We exist through change. If there was no change, we couldn't go on living. Your out-breath changes into an in-breath, which changes into an out-breath. Inhalations and exhalations alternate with each other in that way, and without it, we'd be dead. You can't just keep on breathing in all the time, or breathing out. We exist through change. Food is the same. You put it in one end of your body and it comes out the other. Then you eat some more. That's continual change." Lumpo asked his audience the point of brooding on thoughts of hurt and sorrow about the unchangeable nature of things. Wherever they found themselves, they should do what needed to be done in that place. Wherever they went, they were human beings. They were Buddhists. They should reflect on the truth of their situation in order to make the best of it. Wealth and possessions come and go when conditions are ripe for them to do so. Human beings are born and die and are born again. Suffering only arises when we don't reflect on the changing nature of things." Again, Lumpur is speaking here. "So, may all of you face up to the truth of change taught to us by the Lord Buddha. Be resilient. Wherever you find yourselves, then make that a place where you create goodness and virtue. Even if you come to the end of your life, don't abandon the goodness and virtue that comes from your Dhamma practices. Without Dhamma, there's nothing truly good. Attahi attano nato. It's the self that is the true refuge for the self. Who else could be a refuge to you? That is the truth. When conditions are ripe for things to happen, they happen. Don't spend so much time brooding over it all and causing yourself needless trouble. Put your effort into making an honest living. Do good deeds. Live harmoniously. Help each other out. Be kind to each other. Wherever we live, nobody stays around for very long. Soon, we'll all go our separate ways." So there are some photographs of Lumpur on that trip to France. Mr. Tan Nam, the father of Peng, as a young man. And when he was a young fellow, he was extremely happy to be helping to host Lumpur in France. And certainly, like many of the Cambodian community, he followed up that advice and lived very, very skillfully since then. And has helped at Chithurst Monastery here at Amravati for years and years and years, and the next generation, Peng, and others of the subsequent generation of people have made their lives good in many ways, following this kind of advice that that Lumpo gave, and that it was a time when there was a lot of refugees coming into France and into England from Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam. The boat people were rehoused, so there was that kind of trauma of settling into a new culture, a new society was very much a part of things. That was in the late 70s and early 80s. So that was a very sort of impactful time for those communities. So that was the advice that Lumpo gave at that time, that not to belittle the suffering that people have, but also how the mind can dwell upon the hurts that we have suffered or the wrongs that have been done, and how we can just stew on that. We can just kind of keep recreating and resenting the negative attitudes. And Ajahn Bodhipala, one of the senior nuns in this community, her husband was the deputy prime minister of Cambodia, and she got separated from him in the last days in Cambodia. So she left with their four children, and he literally, they were on their way to the airport to fly out of the country. And she told this story many, many times, and how he said, "I've got to stop in at the ministry for a few minutes, I'll catch you up at the airport." And they never saw each other ever again. So she doesn't know what happened to him, but that was the last of their time together. So then she had to start a new life in the USA, bringing up her children in North Dakota, of all places, which is a lot colder than Cambodia. But she also carried around these resentments and negativity about the war and the Khmer Rouge and the destruction of her country. And then after a certain amount of time, she realized that she was just creating more negativity and more pain in herself. And so through her coming into contact with the Dhamma teachings and seeing the benefit of changing her attitude and working on her own mind, then she was able to really turn things around and to forgive those who had done so much harm, and to be a force for great goodness in not just here in the community in England, but also in Cambodia. She goes over every year and spends quite a few months in Cambodia, and is very active there. Even though she's in her late 70s, she's a powerful force for goodness and for the development of Dhamma practice in Cambodia, and is a very much respected figure within the community on account of her readiness to be able to recognize the harm that was done, but not to just dwell on that or let the mind get drawn towards hatred and fear and resentment, negativity on account of that, but to take the pain of that situation, those memories, and use that pain to wake up. And that's essentially the process of Buddha Dhamma, like I was saying earlier, is a teaching of personal responsibility. It's over and over again, when people lose a loved one, not necessarily in warfare, but someone that's died because of illness or old age, or an accident of some kind, then that's the advice that's given, is that the Buddha encourages us to turn towards that, not to run away from it or just try and make ourselves numb, but to turn towards that painfulness, and to let that pain be something that wakes us up, we make it work for us. And so then this is why aging, sickness, death, these are called the heavenly messengers. They're heavenly. they're what brings the mind towards states of brightness and liberation, even though they are painful and unwelcome messengers. If we receive the message, then they have a liberating quality. So the last section here is Lumpur's diary. So this is called Frog to Pond. Frog as in a little creature?
Yep. Yep.
Frog to pond, to the frog to the water. After 3 months away from Thailand, Lungpo summarized his trip on the last page of his journal with the wordplay that had come to characterize it. And this is a little bit tricky, so I might have to call upon the Thai support team here to do the translation. So, it's 15th of July, 1977. I traveled to the inner outer land and the outer inner land, the inner inner land and the outer outer land, four lands altogether. So would that, I'm asking for some interpretation here, would that be Pratet Nai Nok, Pratet Nok Nai, Pratet Nai Nai, Pratet Nok Nok? Any guesses from our Thai team here? Severa, any thoughts?
Thai book, I don't know. I can find out.
That would be interesting. Do you know, Severa, what is how he phrases that?
I think he will just use the word pretend for both. Pretend nai, pretend no. Pretend no, pretend nai. Pretend nai, pretend nai.
So four lands altogether. The languages that I needed to use in these lands were Niruti, the analytical knowledge of language. And so it produced satisfactory benefit. There is no teacher for these languages. They have to be learned individually. These languages only manifest when prompted by particular events. Thus, the Buddha was well versed in all languages, and I truly saw European people as the four kinds of lotus. So this is talking, there's a little footnote there that says, the Buddha compared four levels of spiritual maturity and readiness to receive the teachings with lotuses. So that there is the four, firstly, the lotus that's sort of still hidden in the mud down at the bottom of the water. Secondly, the lotus rising through the water. Thirdly, rising through the water and blooming on the surface, and then rising above the water, completely emerged and free from the surface of the water. Actually, that first one, the hidden in the mud, is called turtle food. So, the ones who have, that's those lotuses who are not going to do very well other than nourishing turtles. So, again, continuing with Lumpur's diary. I am a monk who's lived in the forest for a long time. I thought that going abroad would be exciting, but it was not, because I was governed by the Buddha in every posture. Not only that, but the journey also gave rise to wisdom. Just as the lotus allows no water to submerge it, my reflections constantly ran directly counter to my surroundings. I visited various universities, and I had the thought that all the sciences of humanity are blunt. They are unable to cut off suffering. They merely generate it. I felt that if these sciences do not rely on Buddha science, they will not survive. On the plane, I had many kinds of unusual feelings, and my mind raised up the Buddha's saying, "Look on this world as grand as a king's chariot. Fools are enamored of it, but the wise remain unbound." So as he's looking out the window from the plane into the clouds, "Look on this world as grand as a king's chariot. Fools are enamored of it, but the wise remain unbound." This saying has become even clearer, as did the phrase about not being proud when in a group whose ways and customs are unfamiliar to you. That has become absolutely clear. So Lumpur had traveled in many different vehicles over the past months. He noted that the plane he was now sitting in was flying at 30,000 feet, its maximum height above ground level. But impressive as such vehicles were, he mused, they were nothing compared to the vehicle of Dhamma. In fact, they were not so amazing at all. Again, Lumpur's diary continues. The vehicles that convey people to their destinations are coarse, because they merely take people who are suffering in one place off to suffer somewhere else. Not a very cuddly observation, is it? But realistic. They merely take people who are suffering in one place off to suffer somewhere else. They just go around in endless circles. My feeling about this trip abroad is that it's been a humorous affair. For many years now, I've felt like I was a lord of monkeys, being poked and teased by spectators. What would it be like, quote unquote, I thought, to go abroad and try being an Ajahn frog for a while? I knew I'd have to be an Ajahn frog for sure, because I didn't know their language. And that's how it turned out. Frogs don't know human language, but the moment they start croaking, people come running. That's because in the Thai countryside, people catch frogs for food. So Ajahn Gop. Gop is the word for a frog. And that's how it turned out. Frogs don't know human language, but the moment they start croaking, people come running. For me, it was like a mute teaching the insane. And that's not so bad. You don't have to study or pass exams to receive the degree offered by the Buddha. And so, a mute monk established a branch monastery in London for insane people to study in. It's comic. So, welcome to the monkey house. He would often refer to the monastery as the Rongpayaban Rokjit, like as a psychiatric hospital. So, this is what monasteries are for. This is to come and make your minds better. And so that the kind of standard that he would encourage is that recognizing that until one is enlightened, then you are crazy. And that's according to Buddhist psychology, that's the case, that sanity comes with arahantship. Anything less than arahantship is a degree of insanity. So this is the psych ward. This is the monkey house. We are less than sane. Yeah, as long as the mind is not fully enlightened, we're like. And then that the image of the monkeys. He would often think of people coming into the monastery and then making offerings to the sangha, and then expecting him to sort of to give them blessings or come up with wise sayings. And it's like going to the zoo and sort of handing out bananas to the monkeys, make the monkeys dance around a bit. So he often would use that image of, like, you know, you come into the monastery treating it like the monkey house, you know, just kind of give them a banana and see if they jump around. You know, maybe you give some blessings or something. So he often would use that kind of a language, or like, particularly for the foreign monks. Oh, they come to see the white monkeys, you know. In a sort of playful, joking, but also kind of somewhat pointed way, that was often how people would just see that, and he could see that he being asked to sort of be a performing animal, you know, but just to sort of feed people's interest, and that they were going to pile out the bus and come and sort of meet you and want the performance, and they pile back on the bus and zoom off again, you know, just be in the monastery for 20 minutes or half an hour. And so he would always try to slow people down. And then often in his Dhamma talks, if you listen to them or read them, he would be quite challenging, say, well, what have you come here for? You say you've come here to make merit, but, you know, what's merit? Did you where are you going to find it here? Where does it come from? And are you going to take it away with you? What does it look like? And so he would try to get people to think rather than just following their customs. Of course, yeah, it's quite a beautiful thing to make a trip, you know, across the country and make offerings to support monasteries, but it could be very at a very superficial level. And then that feeling of just sort of being a performing monkey, kind of a performing Ajahn, kind of doing the tricks to entertain the visitors, he would get a bit fed up with being put into that role. That challenge to people to see things a bit more deeply, to consider, well, what is merit? What is this boon that you're looking for? You know, where does it come from? Do you understand how it works? Do you know what it? If you met some boon, would you recognize it? and to help people to think and to consider what's really meritorious, or why is there goodness in that kind of action, and how can they really benefit themselves. So he was always trying to help people wake up to see what they were doing within themselves, and how to really use their own life and their own mind, their own energy in a skillful way. And but it does happen, you know, sometimes. It's not that common, but sometimes people do relate to you that way, just like Lumpur Panyananda said that the job of an ajahn is not to be a merit postman. Like you're receiving the offering, and you collecting it, like the postman receives the package, and that the person gets the merit by return of post. They give you this thing, and then the merit arrives by return mail. And that would be this expression. He was an elder Thai monk who used to come here to help the community in the 80s and 90s. That not just being a postman, but again, helping people to use their own life, and to wake up to the benefit of the Buddha's teachings as something that they could use to help themselves, rather than feeling the monastery or the sangha or drawing close to an ajahn has some sort of intrinsic value in and of itself, but to ask this question: why is this important? Why are you doing this? You know, why do you bow to me, or why are you giving me these things? Do you know what's that about? So that was a constant effort of Lumpur Cha to help people to understand the customs that they had, and the kind of forms that they used, and to really make them work for them. Remember, Lumpur Sumedho often quotes the time when somebody came up to him and just with a really grumpy look on their face, and looked really kind of upset and negative, and just plunked themselves down in front of him and just said, "Say something wise." I kind of push the button for the... You're the wise saying generator. Like, okay, say something wise, you know, make me feel good. I'm not quite sure what Lumpur Sumedho said at that point, but they probably got a bit of an earful. But that was the request. Say something wise. So that's enough for today. And the next section is the 1979 trip.